This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. There has been a lot in the environmental news lately. One of the biggest headlines involved a lawsuit called Juliana v. United States. Back in 2015, 21 youth plaintiffs had sued the United States, asserting that the U.S. government had violated their rights by encouraging activities that contributed to climate disruption, and therefore that significantly infringed on their rights under the Constitution and something called the Public Trust Doctrine. Cases like these are now called atmospheric trust litigation cases, and this particular one had received a lot of notoriety going forward. The plaintiffs were represented by seasoned lawyers working at a nonprofit called Our Children's Trust. Well, since 2015, I've been watching this case closely, and I have to say I have friends who've advised the lawyers at Our Children's Trust, and I also have a couple of students who've interned at that organization and have helped on this case. I also have colleagues who are also seasoned litigators who, while they were sympathetic to the goals of the case, were somewhat skeptical of using ambitious strategies like this in a court system that is growing more and more politically conservative. Well, last month, a panel of three judges on the Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed the case, and they did that by a vote of 2-1. So what now? Plaintiffs have pledged to appeal. At the same time, there's an assortment of climate-related lawsuits bouncing around state and federal courts, many of them stuck in the same procedural web that ensnared the Juliana plaintiffs here. And I started wondering, well, what can we make of all of this? What is going to happen with climate litigation? And does the case Juliana v. United States affect the future of climate change litigation or the future of climate policy? So I thought today we would dig into the Juliana case, look at the claims carefully, and in particular, look at this dismissal by the Ninth Circuit. There were some very impassioned opinions written on either side. And then start asking the question of, hey, what does this case actually mean for the future of climate change litigation? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Will it have much of a difference at all? So I found two great people to talk to help figure this out. And both of them are member scholars at CPR. The first is Karen Sokol. She's a professor of law at Loyola University, New Orleans, and an expert in these climate litigation cases. We also work together at the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola. And the second was Melissa Powers, a professor at the Lewis and Clark Law School, where she is also director of the Green Energy Institute. For this interview, Karen joined me in person in my office, and we reached Melissa at her office in Portland, Oregon, over the internet. Here's the interview. Melissa Powers and Karen Sokol, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
My first question has to do with the sort of the beginning stages of this case, just so our listeners understand a little bit about it. Back in January on the 17th, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a much-awaited decision that dismissed the case Juliana v. United States. And that was a case that was brought by 21 youths against the United States for its alleged contributions to climate change. Can you, Karen, remind us about the facts leading up to Juliana v. United States and tell us a little bit about what the legal claims involved were?
Sure. So, like you said, 21 young people ranging in age from 8 to 21. They're older now because this was brought in 2015. Also, a plaintiff was a climate scientist acting as a guardian for future generations. And they claimed that the Constitution recognizes a right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life. That was their principal claim. They also had some claims grounded in the public trust doctrine and the Ninth Amendment. But that ended up being the claim that the trial court recognized, which was pretty extraordinary. They said that the government had systematically violated that right through myriad actions over a period of at least half a century by approving, promoting, and subsidizing fossil fuel exploration, extraction, production, transportation, and exportation. And they said that that had harmed them because they were experiencing current harms as a result of more severe storms and flooding, as well as would, if the government continued on this path, experience continued harms.
So there were individual plaintiffs, some of whom might have testified in a deposition saying, there have been a lot of floods in my area and the property value where I live is going down, or somebody saying there's been a drought in my area and I've had to move because of access issues having to do with access to water and these kinds of things.
Exactly.
Is that right? Okay.
Exactly.
And tell me just a little bit about the constitutional claim. So this is a claim that's based in the Fifth Amendment. And of course, the Fifth Amendment doesn't say anything about climate, but the argument is that that within the Liberty Clause or the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment is that there is an implied right to a climate system capable of sustaining life. Is that how it was phrased?
So that's the right that the judge ended up recognizing in the lower court. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much how the plaintiffs phrased it. It was a climate system that's livable, that's habitable. So the due process clause of the Constitution is interesting. Our Constitution doesn't have many enumerated rights. So there have been some rights that have been recognized as being implied by a protection in the due process clause that says you cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So what these plaintiffs argued was that implied in that right was the right to a stable climate system, because without that, you have no life, and without life, you have no liberty or anything else, that is the most basic of rights that there can be, essentially.
You can't have ordered liberty without a civilization that can work properly.
Without a planet that's habitable.
Yes. Without a stable climate. So, Melissa, the federal trial court there had ruled that the case was sufficient to go forward for trial and for discovery to learn more about what the policies of the United States had been in this area. But at the request of defendants, the Ninth Circuit was allowed to weigh in at an intermediate stage, a kind of intermediate appeal, at which time they were allowed, before the trial, to look at some of the jurisdictional aspects of the case and weigh in on them. And that's when the Ninth Circuit dismissed the case, and that's what's prompted so much discussion in the media now, including our discussion here on the podcast. Can you explain a little bit, Melissa, what it was exactly that the Ninth Circuit objected to in terms of jurisdiction and why it reached the conclusion that it did?
So under the Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, courts are supposed to hear cases or controversies. And the Supreme Court for a number of decades has said that for a party to be able to show that there is a case or controversy, that the party needs to show that it has standing to sue. And standing requires a party to show that it has suffered an injury in fact, causation, and redressability. So I'll break these down just a little bit more. For a party to be able to show that they have standing to sue, they need to show that they have an injury in fact that was caused by the defendant's action and that the court is capable of redressing that injury. And I'm going to break those out a little bit more.
Sure.
So in terms of an injury in fact, a party needs to show that it has suffered some type of harm that is both concrete and particularized, and either actual or imminent. So concrete and particularized means that if a party is challenging some type of broader action, the party needs to show that it nonetheless is going to face some type of injury that is specific to that particular plaintiff. And so in the case of Juliana, the youth plaintiffs showed, for example, that their specific property had been damaged by floods and hurricanes, or that in one of the cases, one of the children's family is they farm hazelnuts, and they were alleging that as a result of climate change, their hazelnut farming had become more difficult. So those are very specific injuries to them. Once you show an injury, the action of the defendant that you're challenging and the injuries themselves. And so this is why when they're talking about how climate change has caused their injuries, they also need to say that and the government has contributed to climate change, which in turn has contributed to their injuries. So that's the causal link. And then the last component, redressability, is a requirement that the plaintiff show that it's possible for the court to issue some type of remedy that is going to redress or in some ways provide some type of relief to the plaintiffs in terms of their injuries.
So essentially, the court has to find, or the plaintiffs have to show, that there's been some kind of a concrete injury, that it's been caused by something wrongful that the government's done in this case, and that there is something that the court can do that would make things better for the plaintiffs in some way to avoid this injury in the future.
That's exactly right.
And the idea right behind standing, there are different justifications, I suppose, for standing. But one idea is to make sure that you've got plaintiffs who are really committed to the case and know a lot about it, and, you know, will kind of fight zealously, as we say. And then there's another idea that we shouldn't be having courts intervene into things that are more like legislative problems, right? So sometimes we call these separation of powers problems or separation of powers issues. And so the reason that we might have an analysis like this is to make sure that courts aren't making up legislation, something that Congress should be doing. And instead, what they're doing is what courts are supposed to be doing, which is resolving disputes between particular individualized parties.
That's right. And early on, when the courts were first articulating why they had a standing requirement, it was fundamentally about having courts not weigh in on issues that would result in the courts issuing advisory opinions about what types of law the legislature should pass. So it wanted to make sure that there was, in fact, a legitimate dispute between parties with specific allegations so that the court wasn't mucking around too much outside of a true contest between adverse parties.
And so the court dismissed this case on the grounds that standing didn't exist in a legal sense. What was its main concern here?
So the main concern was redressability. So the third prong about whether the court could issue some type of remedy that would actually redress the plaintiff's injuries.
It's basically saying, yes, climate change is happening. Yes, it's possible that these teenagers who filed the case were experiencing something that was caused by climate change, and even that government policy contributed to climate change. But don't look at us on the bench to do anything about it, because there's nothing that we could do that would make any real difference in this situation.
Right. And the court, to get to that last part of its decision, it divided the redressability analysis into two parts. And the first part was looking at whether the court, in fact, on a practical level, could issue any type of effective relief. And then the second prong was whether the court, basically on a legal level, had the authority to issue the type of relief that the plaintiffs were asking for. So the plaintiffs specifically asked in the case, among other requests for relief, they asked the court to order the federal government to develop what they referred to as a drawdown plan. And it was basically a comprehensive strategic plan for the government to mandate reductions in activities that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions and a transition to zero carbon energy resources. So it was a very broad request for relief. And because in part of that breadth, what the court first of all said was climate change is really, really serious, and that this drawdown plan is necessary to actually prevent the injuries that you have alleged. So in our view, however, we don't have the ability to give you all of the relief that you have asked for in this drawdown plan. And then the court said effectively that if we cannot give you everything that you want, your claims are not redressable because partial fixes are not going to fix climate change.
Okay, so that's interesting, right? So climate change is such a big issue. It is so urgent that it needs a full court press in order to make a stable climate where ordered liberty is possible. And because we can't deliver that, then this is a job for Congress or the executive branch. I just want to stop for a second because I was really struck by reading the decision. I mean, first of all, we should say that this decision about the dismissal, it was a 3-judge panel and it was a vote 2-3. And so the two in the and everybody seemed very sympathetic to climate change. And in fact, all 3 judges were Obama appointees. And Judge Andrew Hurwitz, he opens with this. He opens his entire decision with this reference to a Barry McGuire song, right from 1965. This kind of folk anthem on the eve of destruction, which is a song about Congress and the government actually not living up to its standards. It's a song protesting racism. It's a song protesting the Vietnam War and so on. And then Hurwitz says, and I'm going to quote here, he says, "The record leaves little basis for denying that climate change is occurring at an increasingly rapid pace." And then he says later on, "The problem is approaching the point of no return. Absent some action, the destabilizing climate will bury cities, spawn life-threatening natural disasters, and jeopardize critical food and water supplies." Now these are the words of the guy who's just about to say, "And by the way, we're not going to do anything about it." Is that, Karen, was that surprising to you when you were reading the decision, this dismissal?
Well, actually, his opening made it clear to me that they were going to dismiss the case.
Oh, so how did you know? How could you figure that out?
It was just this dramatic opening that seemed almost starting with an apology, so to speak. And also, there are some other cases which aren't constitutional cases, are based on tort law, where the defendants have brought similar arguments, which are essentially any case about the climate crisis is not one for the courts. It is for the executive and the legislator to do anything, if anything is going to be done. And the judges have come out different ways in terms of whether they agree with that, but the judges that have agreed that it's not for courts have had a similar sort of lament that this is horrible. We recognize that these are harms. We even recognize that there could be a rights violation here, but there's nothing we can do about it. You need to go to Congress, to the president, and seek redress there.
But the courts clearly know. I mean, if they're sympathetic to the situation, I could understand a court that wasn't sympathetic to the situation. But here, they absolutely understand the science. They're absolutely concerned. It's a point of no return that we're approaching. And everybody on that panel must know that neither the president nor the Congress is going to do anything about this in the short term.
Right, and they are the defendants. The president is the defendant in this case. So I think that's right. There was a dissent. So you mentioned there were three
right.
judges
mm-hmm.
on the panel.
Josephine Stanton was the dissenter.
Yes,
yeah.
a district judge sitting by designation on the panel. And she sharply disagreed. And her opinion includes very effective critique of their application of standing doctrine. And what she indicates in her opinion is that the majority just nevertheless, this is her words, throws up its hands. And I think that there's a lot of fear on the part of courts because although there's an increasing number of these cases, they're still all hung up at the motion to dismiss stage, at least in this country. And a court has not yet grappled with this sort of massive harm and sort of massive systematic rights violation. It's a big task for the court. It doesn't mean courts don't have a role in addressing it, but it's one that they don't have a lot of precedent mm-hmm. to go mm-hmm. on because these are the first climate harm cases. And courts like precedent. They like feeling comfortable, particularly when they're not the highest court, when they have a court potentially reviewing them. The Ninth Circuit is an appellate court, but the Supreme Court's in charge. So there's
always that looming.
And the Supreme
Court had weighed in, hadn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting and complex. It was hard for me to keep up. But the short of it is that so the Trump administration really didn't want to have the trial. So like you mentioned, Judge Aiken in the lower court had ruled that they had standing and that they had established enough to be sufficient to go forward. So they hadn't had their day in court yet. They were just going to get their trial, go to discovery and get their trial. The government said, and normally if you object to that, you wait till the trial's over.
Right.
But
right.
the government said, no, we can't go through all this trial and discovery and all of that stuff. We're going to go ahead and appeal now and get this resolved now. And the Ninth Circuit initially said, you can't do that. This isn't merited. Just go through the trial, normal procedure. And they said, we're taking it to the Supreme Court. So the short of it is they've done all of this twice. And the Supreme Court has never agreed with them, but essentially gave what seemed to be a message to the Ninth Circuit in an opinion saying, we think you should grant this what's known as interlocutory appeal mm-hmm. in between the trial.
Yeah.
So that's how we have the Ninth Circuit. So the judges probably had in their mind, the Supreme Court has indicated it might reverse this case.
Right.
And
then
the
Ninth Circuit
reversed.
Kind of indicated to the trial court, you better go back and be very careful about what you've just done and maybe allow it to be appealed to us,
right.
the judges on the Ninth Circuit.
Which she ultimately did. So it was this not very thinly veiled threat from the Supreme Court.
Melissa, I want to ask you a little bit about this claim and the remedy because of course they're so tied together, right? I mean, the claim, as I read it, is that it's not just that the United States government was, let's say, passive in allowing greenhouse gases to accumulate to such a degree that they caused this threat. It was actually that the U.S. government, in many, many ways, was contributing affirmatively to this problem. In other words, it was subsidizing the fossil fuel industry in myriad ways. It was subsidizing and adopting strategies of transportation that were inconsistent with renewable resources. It was allowing the mining and the drilling of fossil fuels on its own property, on public lands, our property, when it knew that that was contributing. So one of the issues was that there are many things, I mean, so many agencies throughout the federal government that were doing things that were contributing to this problem on a daily basis. And I take it, you know, from reading the majority's opinion that, geez, what would you expect a court to do? I mean, would you have to have a court, you know, redesign the energy policy of the United States, redesign the transportation strategies, redesign the leasing rules on public lands? I mean, it does seem, I have to say, at first blush, I'm not sure I can imagine a federal court ever doing as much as that. And so, but I want to get to your point, Melissa, because your point is as well, just because they can't do the whole thing doesn't mean they can't do something. So what are the things that you think the federal courts could have plausibly done, and why would have that have made a difference?
So the court could have issued an order to the executive branch of the U.S. government telling it to come up with a plan that would be adequate to address climate change. And by simply remanding it back to the executive branch, at the very least, the decision-making about what would be feasible, what might not be legally feasible, what might not be practically feasible, would have at the first been within the executive branch, whose agencies are usually making the decisions about where they're going to authorize oil and gas leasing, what types of projects they're going to subsidize, what types of projects they're going to permit. And so I do think that the remedy was really very broad on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, the plaintiffs were not asking the court to develop this strategy. They were asking the court to order the executive branch to develop the strategy. And that type of remand order is not unprecedented in terms of both constitutional law, but then outside of the constitutional context, in other scenarios in which the court has found that an agency has in one way or the other violated the law.
One thing that struck me, Melissa, hearing you make that argument, is that Judge Hurwitz seems to conclude before any kind of fact-finding that it would be impossible for a court to plausibly do something that could make a difference. Now, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but it sounds like what you're suggesting is that you wouldn't know that that's the case until you were to have discovery, listen to the testimony of witnesses, and see basically what parts of the government might be able to come up with a plan that might significantly reduce carbon in a way that would help these plaintiffs. But the, without knowing that, I guess, as Karen says, the court did sort of throw up its hands before even doing a factual inquiry to see whether there was something that was possible. I'm going to take us in a slightly different direction, because you had mentioned that there are examples of courts in constitutional situations and also other kinds of legal situations in which there are situations in which courts have supervised intricate remedies of one kind or another. And so I was thinking, you know, on one hand, it seems understandable to say that perhaps a court shouldn't be in the business of supervising all of government energy policy or transportation strategy and so on, you know, because that's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of moving parts. But on the other hand, as Judge Stanton points out in the dissent, there are examples, and you pointed this out too, where federal courts, and I'll say in particular in the 60s and 70s, at a time that Barry McGuire was singing, that in the 60s and 70s, there were situations in which federal courts were supervising very complicated remedies. I mean, they took over, the federal courts took over supervision of desegregating tens of thousands of school districts around the country, particularly because it didn't seem that the executive branch or the legislative branch was up to the task. And that was, of course, an enormously complicated endeavor that lasted many, many years. I guess the question that I have, and I'll turn to you, Karen, first, the question I have is, what's the difference today? I mean, we have all of these judges on the bench in this Ninth Circuit panel were progressives of one kind or another. And when I read the decision of the majority, when I look at the decisions of other judges around the country, I just don't get the sense that even progressive judges have the kind of appetite for the judicial activity that took place in the 50s and 60s related to desegregation. And I guess what I'm wondering is that in our time, is that because judges just have a different theoretical idea of what courts should be doing or what they're capable of? Or is it that, at least at the time in the 50s and 60s, the issue of race seemed much more urgent to people than climate change seems today?
Well, I can't get in the heads of the courts, but I think that both of those, it's likely some combination of both of those. The attorney Julia Olson, in her oral argument before the Ninth Circuit, brought up the civil rights era cases, and particularly with respect to concerns about a remedy, as saying, look, you've done this sort of thing before. You essentially ordered desegregation of public schools. It wasn't easy, but you figured out a way to do it, and it was necessary because of the rights violation. The courts had a role. And I think it was quite effective. Another difference, I will say, is that the case Brown versus Board, the one that you're referring to, there was a full trial. So all the factual inquiries about the case, there was a lot more information. That's what a trial serves to do. We didn't have that in this case because this appeal is early. It's premature, so to speak. And that sort of development allows courts the opportunities to grapple with what they might do. They have a lot of discretion in figuring out the best remedy to issue. So the initial question is there a rights violation? Next, what can we do about it? And in fact, Brown, there was a whole separate briefing just on how the courts would craft a remedy.
Brown 2,
right.
Part 2. And that's where the phrase all deliberate speed
exactly.
comes from.
And mm-hmm. so, but because of the way that this case has been sped up and dismissed at this stage, we don't have the benefit of all that deliberation and all that information. And it might seem less daunting to a court if they were to just face all of the facts and actually grapple with what they could do.
That's an interesting point. I mean, you might imagine if you could have talked to the judges right on the cusp of the trial of Brown v. Board of Education and say, oh, by the way, we imagine a future where the federal courts will be desegregating all schools in the country, that probably would have scared them to death. Right.
And then it was a similar matter. It wasn't the federal government versus the courts. That is, this should be the federal government. It was, look, states are in charge of education. The federal courts have no business.
Yeah.
So, of course, you tell them that at the beginning when the case is basically just still a complaint with allegations and no development, no witnesses or anything else. And then it became clear. Yes, the federal government has a role, and in particular, the courts have a role.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Melissa? Are there other reasons? Well, let me see. Do you share this instinct that I have, this feeling that courts are less ambitious about judicial intrusion into government management than they were in the 60s and 70s?
I do, and I actually think another case that the plaintiffs relied on actually exemplifies this, even though it was a case that actually favored the plaintiffs. And it's a different Brown case. It's Brown versus Plata. And so in Brown versus Plata, there was a challenge against the California prison system, basically because it was so overcrowded that it was causing a host of constitutional violations of the prisoners' rights. And in that case, the federal courts, had initially just directed the Department of Prisons to remedy the violations. And after a very long time and very little progress, the court actually intervened and it directly ordered a reduction in the prison population. So the court's involvement really was just saying, you have to figure out a way to lower your prison population. Nothing as complex as what they were asking for in Juliana, but a direct intervention in terms of the remedy. And although the Supreme Court affirmed that decision, it found that it was an appropriate judicial intervention at the remedy stage. It was also a contested decision, so there were two dissents in the case. And the level of intervention of the federal courts was much, much less than what you saw in Brown versus Board of Education. And so I think that the fact that this case made it up to the Supreme Court, the fact that the court barely approved it, does signal that increasingly federal courts see themselves as less empowered to actually issue remedies to help address some of society's biggest problems.
Do you think that that is affecting the way the law of standing and the law of federal jurisdiction is being interpreted? And I say it this way because I know that there are issues of standing, and then there are also sometimes issues of what we call political questions, the idea being that that there are some kinds of questions, like maybe energy policy, that are so fraught with politics that that courts should not be calling the shots in those situations. And in this particular case, it seems to me, at least, that the political question doctrine and the standing doctrine are kind of they overlap. But I guess I'm wondering, do you think that courts may be showing a trend toward interpreting the law to grant less jurisdiction because they're afraid of the possibility of the interventions that you're describing?
In my view, yes. And in some ways, I can understand that. Although Karen earlier was talking about some of the other early climate cases that had been brought and noting that concerns about separation of powers, which were translated into dismissal on political question grounds, were proceeding pursuant to a whole set of tests that have been developed to have the courts assess whether there is, in fact, truly a political question, or whether instead there are viable legal claims that certainly are political, but they are still within the province of the court. What I think has happened in this case is the majority in dismissing the case on redressability grounds, it basically said, we don't think that we have the ability to address this because fundamentally this should be in the hands of the elected branches of government, Congress and the executive branch. But by doing that, what the court has basically done is it's imported the political question analysis into the standing doctrine, but without following the specific test that courts are supposed to follow when they dismiss a case on political question grounds.
Yeah.
And to me, the risk of that is a court might get to redressability and just say, gee, this is hard. This is a political issue, or at least I think that the policymakers should be dealing with this. I don't want to deal with it, so I'm going to call it overtly political, and therefore I'm backing out.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I'm looking at the dissents that Josephine Staten wrote, and she's, you know, of course, in the beginning of her dissent says that she thinks the court is throwing up its hands. And then as this opinion of hers reaches crescendo, she says, plaintiff's claims are based on science, specifically an impending point of no return. If plaintiffs' fears, backed by the government's own studies, prove true, history will not judge us kindly. When the seas envelop our coastal cities, fires and droughts haunt our interiors, and storms ravage everything between, those remaining will ask, why did so many do so little? And, I mean, that's a huge question, right? I mean, when you have the elected branches of government saying, we can't move. There's not enough room for us to build policy around this. And then you have the courts doing the same. What does that leave us with?
I mean, at this point, it leaves, in a lot of places, communities advocating to their local governments, sometimes their state government.
Let's take a break. Folks, I know some of you have found at the CPR website the show page for Connect the Dots, and I just want to remind you that it's a great place to find many of the materials that my guests talk about and also get more information about what CPR is doing on many of the issues that appear on this podcast. So if you go to progressivereform.org and find our show page, you'll find for this episode a slew of materials on climate litigation and climate change in general, including blog posts on the Giuliano case by Karen Sokol, Melissa Powers, and another member scholar, Joel Mintz. You'll also find some of our other work on climate litigation. I also made sure we put a YouTube link to Barry McGuire performing The Eve of Destruction, that folk song that Judge Hurwitz quotes in the opening of his opinion. We don't have the rights to play that song, but you do not want to miss this video. And you tell me, over and over, and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Let's get back to the interview. One way of looking at this, this landscape of climate litigation, is to say, well, this was a case in which plaintiffs overplayed their hand. They asked for way too much, and it seemed way too scary to the federal judges who were trying to grapple with how are we going to change the entire energy policy of the United States. Now, there are other cases, and I know, Karen, that you've written about these other types of lawsuits before that ask for more specific kinds of remedies. Some of them are asking for remedies of money that might be used to adapt to climate change for a community or for a state. Some are asking for, I guess, more focused remedies or changes in policies. What do you think the advantage, I guess, of a case like that is? Maybe you avoid what Melissa's been talking about in terms of courts throwing up their hands. What might you be able to get realistically out of a set of cases based on that litigation?
The tort cases?
Yeah, the tort cases, yeah.
Well, as far as I know, they are all asking for damages. So they're not asking for any sort of policy changes. Mm-hmm. The distinction about these cases, in addition to the remedy requested, of course, is the source of law. It's tort law. As well as Melissa mentioned, the identity of the defendant. So this isn't the government. It sets policy. It's the big producers of fossil fuel products. So Shell, BP, Chevron, Exxon, they're all defendants in these cases, or mm-hmm. fossil fuel industry defendants. So they may have influence over policy, but they don't set policy. All the damage, the requests are for damages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So courts like damages better. One, it's an amount of money. It's not an order for a policy plan. There's really the level of supervision required isn't the same as if there was some sort of ongoing requirement to set policy. My fear is similar to Melissa's, and that's that this really isn't about redressability in the sense of, can courts order this remedy? They've taken the political question doctrine and done exactly what there's this foundational political question case from the 60s. And Justice Brennan wrote the majority opinion in that case, and he said basically it was a word of caution to courts. This is a very limited doctrine. It's a political question doctrine, not political cases. And the reasoning of the majority's opinion seems to be this is about systematic climate disruption. It's about a global emergency that, yes, the U.S. government has a big role in addressing, but not the courts, just the executive and the legislator. And I fear that what they're doing is exactly what Justice Brennan warned again, which is saying this entire category of cases, courts have no role in, whether it's damages, whether it's an injunction, no matter what, how you craft the remedy you ask for, we can't intervene in this. And that's what really concerns me about this decision and the couple of other tort cases where there have been similar rulings. It's basically a very sloppy analysis,
right?
That is not adhering to any identifiable doctrine. It's just a generalized political matter.
Right, right. And you know, if I recall Brennan's opinion in this is Baker versus Carr. Yeah, it seems to me that then. The concern where there were particular situations maybe that really involved foreign policy choices that you would want a president to make on his or her own, or policies having to do with what an impeachment trial should look like, and that you wouldn't want a court kind of deciding, micromanaging what something like that should look like, because it's clearly stated in the Constitution that another branch of government is supposed to control that, but that there are a lot of issues, a lot of tort issues that involve large economic issues and large financial decisions, right? And they have political implications, but they're not solely political questions, I guess, is the way to say
it. And a case against an industry that has a lot of economic and political might in this country, and certainly a case against the federal government, is going to seem political. I mean, it's, yeah, you know, there's no way around that, but that's not the doctrine.
Right. Melissa, I have a question for you, because I have to confess, I have been following, like many people, this case from the time it was filed, and it's been a hugely inspiring case, just because of the idea that young people were involved, and it was promoting these very interesting issues having to do with the Constitution. And in some ways, I think that this case was a victory the day that it was filed, because it just seemed to capture the spirit of a youth movement, and it captured a lot of people's imaginations. But I have to confess that I always kind of wondered whether it was a good idea. And let me explain what I mean by that. If the case had gone to trial, and if they had won at trial, I assume that it would have been appealed by the government and that it would have gone to the Ninth Circuit. And even if the Ninth Circuit had, against what we now know it has done, but even if you had judges on the Ninth Circuit who said, yes, this was properly before the court and there was a proper trial, we all know that this case eventually would have found its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court as it's currently constituted. Or at least constituted in a way that will probably have at least five conservative justices. And that at that point, it seemed to me that there was much more risk for plaintiffs than there would be opportunity for an advantage, because the very least that would happen is the Supreme Court would knock the case back down and say that there was no jurisdiction. But the very most that could have happened on the other side is that the Supreme Court might have actually read political question doctrine and standing doctrine so differently that it might have imperiled these narrower cases that Karen is talking about. So what do you think about that? I mean, I guess another way of saying it is, was there an end game that actually would have helped plaintiffs in some way? Or was this doomed to failure from the beginning because of the makeup of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do tend to lean in the direction of probably doomed to failure, although I expected that the case would be ultimately dismissed actually based on the breadth of the constitutional claim, that the court would just say whatever the, you know, past history of due process claims have been, they've never involved such a capacious set of actions, and the danger creation exception that would allow the plaintiffs to be able to bring this type of claim is not so broad as to apply to this full range of activity.
There's no right to a stable climate.
Exactly. More specifically, yeah. And in some ways, I think I would have preferred that as an outcome, in part because this type of case has not ever been brought before, and it would have been groundbreaking and precedential. But the flip side is if they had lost on those grounds, there wasn't a risk that other types of broadly applicable doctrines could then be employed in a way that would make it harder for parties to litigate climate-related injuries. And that's why I'm concerned about this case. Not only about the sloppy, as Karen noted, importation of the political question issue into redressability, but because the Ninth Circuit seems to say that if you cannot fix climate change and avoid all of your injuries entirely, you do not have a redressable claim. And I think that's dangerous, whether it's coming from the Ninth Circuit. I mean, certainly it would be worse if it were coming from the Supreme Court. But coming from the Ninth Circuit, you see in standing law that little snippets of cases then start to create the new doctrine, even if the factual scenario is quite different. And so although I do think they dodged a bullet, assuming that the Ninth Circuit does not grant en banc review and reverse the panel, assuming this case is done, I think they dodged a bullet by not getting to the Supreme Court. But I also think that there are some very dangerous paragraphs in this decision that will make it difficult for other climate litigants moving forward.
Interesting. So as you point out, the plaintiffs in this case have said, at least in the press, that they're interested in appealing en banc, as you say, which would mean that all of the judges of the Ninth Circuit would sit in a complete panel and rehear the issues again. And I guess what you're saying, this is what I'm slightly afraid of too, is if that were to happen and come out a different way, then we might see this move up to the U.S. Supreme Court and the Supreme Court come out with a decision that would be more detrimental to these other cases.
Right, right. But I do think that this has some worrisome language in it that will certainly affect litigation within the Ninth Circuit, but it could influence litigation outside of the Ninth Circuit as well.
The one thing I'd say, the silver lining of sorts about the Ninth Circuit decision, although I do fear that it could portend it making it more difficult for lots of other climate harm plaintiffs to bring cases because of the sweeping nature of the political question redressability hybridization, which is a really good way of putting it, as Melissa said. The interesting thing about this case was not only, well, the Ninth Circuit didn't recognize the right, it just assumed and didn't decide. So we still have a good law opinion stating that. But also that confirmed that the plaintiffs had alleged a violation. And that's a difficult thing to do with constitutional violations in our law, because you have to demonstrate what the court is going to read in most circumstances as affirmative action. And the court did recognize here a bunch of different actions by agencies. So leasing, subsidizing, fossil fuel extraction, all these affirmative actions. So it did recognize that that amounted to an alleged violation. Mm-hmm. And normally, climate plaintiffs or even plaintiffs in other environmental cases, they have to go after one agency and one action. It's divided up. So you really, particularly with something like climate, that the nature of the harm is so big and systematic and the contribution of it is, to show the court the whole picture, you've got to show a lot of agencies' actions. That was the advantage to a constitutional right. And they were able to do that. So if plaintiffs going forward are able to challenge not just one agency's action, but show a pattern that's causing the overall harm, the violation, I think that's quite powerful, and particularly from an environmental perspective, is necessary for it to even make sense, for it to match the nature of the harms.
That there's something structural going on here,
exactly.
Not just single decisions.
Right.
I have a question for each of you. It's the same question. We've mentioned that there are a number of these climate litigation cases percolating in the courts around the country. Melissa, is there one of these cases in particular that you are watching?
Well, I've been paying attention to the cases that have been filed in California. So there are a couple of different city governments that basically have sued the various oil companies and other fossil fuel companies and are alleging, somewhat similarly to this case, that these companies promoted fossil fuel resources, notwithstanding their knowledge of the impacts on climate change, and that they tried to conceal those impacts as they continue to promote the sales of their harmful products. And the reason I'm quite interested in these cases, in part, is back to the remedy. They're saying, look, we're not going to try to get a court to stop them from engaging in this behavior. We need the resources financially so that we can take steps that we need to take to address climate change. And I think the narrowness of their relief, but also the fact that they are really trying to get the court to find that these companies knew and despite their knowledge proceeded with activities that have proven to be very harmful, will help shine a light on their culpability. And I think they win, it will also help basically ensure that local communities do start to get access to the very significant financial resources they're going to need.
Great. And I just want to make a plug that a couple seasons ago, I actually interviewed a member of Marin County's government. Marin County has such a case, and it may be one that you're looking at, precisely seeking those kinds of damages that you mentioned. Karen, is there a particular case that you've been tracking for a particular reason that you think is particular, that it's interesting for us to keep an eye on?
Well, like you mentioned, I've been following the tort cases pretty closely, and the ones that Melissa mentioned are some of the tort cases. Mm-hmm. They've been filed all over the nation, and the issue that's come to a head and that will actually be decided in the California cases soon by the Ninth Circuit, I think soon, is whether they belong in federal or state court. So the other difference with these cases from Juliana is not only the identity of the defendant and the source of law, but also the court in which the plaintiffs filed. So none of these plaintiffs filed in federal court. They filed in state court because it's tort law is state. So they filed state tort law claims in state court. And the fossil fuel industry defendants' defense strategy has been to keep this in federal court. So they remove it to federal court. The Ninth Circuit, another Ninth Circuit panel, is to hear argument and then decide whether the California cases belong in federal or state court. It'll be really interesting, and there's the same issue throughout the country and other cases that have been filed. So it'll be interesting if these are allowed to proceed in state court, because issues like political question and standing, each state has their own doctrine. And tort law is different. State courts are very familiar with tort law. So it'll be interesting to see how state courts deal with similar defenses. They're going to assert the similar defenses, the political question, standing, all of that. But it's going to be in state court. And I think it'll be really interesting if they're allowed to proceed to trial in states and see how that plays out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, we spent most of our time talking about the separation of powers that is between Congress and the presidency and the courts. And now you're bringing up another kind of separation, the separation between the federal judicial system and the state judicial system. And it seems like all of these boundaries are being tested in these climate cases. And I know all three of us, we teach in this area, and I am constantly amazed by in my environmental courses how I seem to be talking about process all the time. You know, the process of litigation, the process of how government is structured.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of the bird's eye view of it. It's interesting because it is essentially citizens using the various centers of power,
right,
to try to get a remedy, to get somebody to do something. And that's the whole point of having different centers of power. And right now in the climate crisis, it's important.
Karen Sokol, Melissa Powers, thanks so much for joining me today on Connect the Dots.
Thanks so much for having me.
Me too. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's our show. Make sure to like us on your app and subscribe to us too. You can tell your friends about us on social media. And make sure to visit our show page to find more information on my guests and the topics that we discussed. You'll find it again at www.progressivereform.org. We're always interested to know your reactions to the show, and at the end of this season, I'm going to be devoting a special episode just to the mail I receive. So if you have any questions or comments about anything related to health, safety, or the environment, just send it in. You can reach me at rob@progressivereform.org. I'll make sure that I have a guest on hand, too, to help answer those questions. Also, follow me on Twitter if you like. @RobVercik, all one word. Thanks again to the Center for Environmental Law at the Loyola University New Orleans. Bryant Gum is our assistant producer. Our music today was performed by Kevin McLeod, and our theme music, as always, is by Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.